Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Justin Ross. That's spelled R-O-S-S. My registration number is 38573. I'm counsel for the appellant who was and remains the respondent father in the underlying dependency and neglect matter. I was also co-counsel at trial. The heart of the legal system is fairness, an object which is too often lost in the complex legal arguments sometimes that we as lawyers make trial court level, and I suppose at the appellate court level as well. Fairness has been defined and redefined as issues concerning due process, both procedural and substantive. That is, notice an opportunity to be heard so as to avoid the possibility, or probability maybe more precisely, of someone being deprived of fundamental liberty interest, in this case, the fundamental interest to parent one's own child. Due process in Colorado, in addition to constitutional guarantees, have been codified and regulated by various rules and statutes, civil procedure rules, rules of evidence, certain statutes that incorporate issues that go to due process. In this case, the trial court erred in application of those rules and in these general concepts of fairness that would help define, refine, and explain how the rule would be applied in an unusual proceeding, such as a juvenile proceeding, which to a degree is exempted, and I'll talk a little bit about that, accepted in certain ways from regular rule of procedure. Such ultimately resulted in violations of the father's due process and deprived him of the right to a fair trial in this case. I'd like to focus my argument today on three issues, the first of which is the admission of a plethora of undifferentiated potential hearsay statements by the court, and I'll start with that. The ideology of how this happened at the trial level was a pretrial motion was filed by the state asking that certain out-of-court statements which were potentially hearsay could be admitted. The reason being that one of the hearsay exceptions within the Colorado Rules of Evidence would apply, or the statutory exception in 1325.129 would apply. The court made certain findings, but certainly did not flesh out each statement. The problem is that these statements were reduced to something just slightly less than 30 pages of potential statements, almost all of the child in this case. Some were made to the mother, some were made to caseworkers, some were made to unknown third parties who were never identified for various reasons. If these statements were admissible as an exception under the Colorado Rules of Evidence, each one should have been identified by the court and findings should have been made as to why they were an exception to the hearsay rule. That was not done. Instead, the court generally wholesale adopted and said, paraphrased slightly here, it's admissible under one of these circumstances, one of these exceptions, either a rule of evidence or 1325.129. The problem with the statutory exception in application is that it requires a two-fold analysis, both of which are mandatory. The second in sequence, but the first that I'll address because it's more easy, is whether or not the declarant, in this case the child, testifies at trial, which did not happen, or whether or not there's a finding that the child, in this case, is unavailable to testify. There was never a motion, a suggestion, a request, a finding, an order, anything that touched on whether or not this child was available or unavailable to testify. So that prong, which is mandatory to meet that exception, was never met. The second prong, which in sequence is actually subsection one, is that each statement has to be analyzed for time, content, and circumstances. The point of this...
Mr. Ross, I'm sorry to interrupt you before you go on. Was there any discussion or objection from your client about the lack of a finding that the child was unavailable, or was there any suggestion that the child was available made to the court below?
Your Honor, my recollection is there was no record on that made by either party.
So there's no objection on that basis?
There's no, not that I recall. I examined the record in preparation for today, but
okay.
I don't recall that.
Thank you.
But nevertheless, both bonds are mandatory, so to the extent that that might have some effect on the court, I would submit that the second prong, I've confused everyone here, but the prong where the statements need to be analyzed, that was not met as well. And the reason is there is a difference in the reliability of a statement based upon time, content, and circumstances. If, for example, you have a child talking to a trained social worker or therapist, law enforcement officer, any of these people that have some sort of training as to how to conduct a proper forensic interview, that presumably would be more reliable, for example, than saying it to maybe a respondent mother who's at odds with her now ex-husband and in a custody battle. In this case, we have statements that are all over the map. Some made to all sorts of parties. None of that analysis ever occurred to find that the time, content, and circumstances of each of these statements was sufficient to allow the statutory exception to take hold for any of these statements. Now, there has been some suggestion that because the appellant has been unable to or did not in the brief say which statements were error is somehow requesting this court to ferret out a problem and is prejudicial to the appeal, I would suggest the problem is with the trial court because we were never put on notice as to which of these were admitted under which exception, so it's impossible to present that to this court as to what happened because it was this wholesale adoption. It's all coming in.
Well, Chris, couldn't you have identified in the opening brief the particular statements as they came into evidence, not as they were argued pretrial, and explained for those statements how they were prejudicial, which I find no reference in the brief?
I suppose that is entirely possible within the constraints of how long my brief could be, Your Honor. But when you're talking about a ruling from a trial court that basically suggests to the respondent, your objections will all be overruled, it doesn't matter, it's all coming in, the argument then becomes not any of the particular statements were prejudicial, it's that the entirety of the ruling is prejudicial.
But I mean, isn't it a two-step transaction? Even if the pretrial ruling was in error, don't you still have to show us what statements came in and make, at least to some extent, a separate argument either for each statement or for each category of statements as to how you were prejudiced? For example, there's significant evidence in the record that some of this information, you know, came in through other sources anyway, so it would be cumulative. And we can't solve that since you haven't identified the particular statements as they came in to which you take issue.
Well, there were examples of statements that came in, Your Honor. And some of those would be, and all three of the briefs really brought separate examples of that in. For example, the child yelling out in her sleep, where the only witness to that is her mother, of things about Satan and Daddy and sort of these odd statements. For example, that would be one. But certainly, I suppose it's possible to ferret all those out. But rather, what the brief incorporates, the motion itself, and the exhibits attached to the motion, which are in the record. So I hope that answers the court's question.
Mr. Ross, I had a different question on statements and prejudice. If we look at the jury's findings, there's a number of findings that the jury made. I don't see how a lot of those, or at least some of those, would be supported by child hearsay. So I'm getting to a harmless error analysis.
Well, let me talk about the harmless error because I think that's pertinent to the issue of really the expert witness issue, and I'll try and address these all together.
Okay.
Hopefully that'll answer your question. One of the issues before the court is whether or not, all the issues ultimately, there's the argument made on the other side that this is quote unquote harmless error. And one of those that I'd like to incorporate in is this issue of the expert disclosure. Rule 26 doesn't, CRCP 26 doesn't automatically include juvenile cases. There's language in there to say that this is excluded, but it doesn't prevent the court from incorporating Rule 26. And in this case, the trial court actually implicated Rule 26 twice. once in the pretrial order for witness disclosures implicating the subjects pursuant to 26. And then again, when we objected to the expert testimony, the court found the expert was an expert pursuant to 26A2. So there is a due process issue, because that's all that the rules are ultimately, is the attempt to make uniform and to an extent codify due process protections for litigants, I would submit. So some disclosure is clearly required. This idea that whether it's the expert or whether it's the statements or anything is quote unquote harmless error, I think it's confusing the issue, because ultimately when you're talking about harmless error, at least in the disclosure arena, that's really a discussion of whether or not the trial court has made a finding of whether the late disclosure is substantially justified or harmless.
Well, let's talk about harmlessness. The lower court allowed, required the state to set forth a summary of the opinion, and then took a recess and allowed father's trial counsel to talk to the expert, correct?
That's correct.
And at the end of that process, there was no renewal of an inadequate disclosure argument, correct?
There was not a renewal that I recall, but there certainly was an objection previous to that one.
Okay, well, why isn't it waived by virtue of the events that transpired after the objection?
Well, I don't know that one has to continue to raise an objection after one has already raised it at trial. And I don't think the objection was tendered until I get a chance to speak on the third day of trial for 15 minutes with an expert, I would object. I think the objection was not made within those boundaries.
Okay.
And on that,
Mr. Ross, could I go back to my earlier question? I understand the expert disclosure issue, but let me take a different look at this. The jury made a finding of physical abuse. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And was there evidence, I believe, evidence that he disciplined the child by spanking with a yardstick and wooden spoon? He used enough force while spanking to break the yardstick.
There was contested evidence to that effect, Judge.
Okay, so did that evidence rely on child hearsay?
Yes. And let me back up, because I'm trying to understand, satisfy the court's question. The problem with Hennessy neglect cases is that the consequence of an adjudication results in a treatment plan. But a treatment plan can be quite broad. It can be, for example, if someone has an alcohol problem. It can be treatment for alcohol addiction or substance abuse. If someone has a mental health issue, it can be mental health. If someone has an economic circumstance where they can't provide, they need to provide a situation where the child can not be dependent and neglected based on economic circumstances. Even if a jury had adjudicated the father as to the physical abuse allegations, these other allegations, including sexual abuse, which is really the most insidious of allegations as far as a treatment plan is concerned, might not have been sustained had this been properly tried. And so I understand what the court's saying is that there might have been this other evidence that would have led to an adjudication, but this is not, it's sort of like a criminal case where you've got maybe a felony and a misdemeanor, and the consequences of such are very, very different.
So it's your position that the basis of the adjudication would limit the scope of the treatment plan?
Yes. That is my
position. Case law or statutes to support that?
I certainly can supplement the record with that, but that is my position. That's the law. Briefly, regarding the 19-1307 disclosure issue, since I'm running out of time, I wanted to let the court know and submit that the reason why that is pertinent is because it's not an issue of whether or not these documents were properly submitted as impeachment evidence, because it's not a discovery issue. It's an open records issue. And the state essentially represented to the father, pursuant to the statute, that the entirety of that record had been made available, and then produced documents that had been withheld as a matter of trial strategy.
How's he prejudiced if he was the originator of the documents in the first place?
He's prejudiced because he doesn't know what's in that file. The statute itself, which requires disclosure of the file, does not allow for an exception of documents that may or may not already be in the requestor's possession.
Well, but that's not responsive to my question of prejudice. I mean, okay, he didn't know what was in their file. Presumably, he knew what he had done, and these documents were documents that he created.
Well, he doesn't know what's in the file. He doesn't have access to the file unless it's been given to him.
Well, I think we're going in circles. How is he prejudiced by being impeached with a document that he created, whether it was produced in advance or part of the file or not?
Because it's a file that should have been in his possession. That should have been disclosed to him. He should have known that the opposing party had this file and might have access to it and might use it against him in trial. It's not his responsibility to investigate every single possibility of what might be brought against him by the petitioner in this case, including digging into his own personal history and emails and letters, which he may or may not have kept.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court, John Thurkell, spelled T as in Tom, H-I-R-K-E-L-L, Assistant Douglas County Attorney, on behalf of the appellee petitioner. Attorney registration number 13865. Beginning with one aspect, it was not for trial strategy that the emails of the father were not turned over. That's regrettable. In an ideal world, we would have been able to provide full disclosure, and I do apologize for that. However, on that point, we do agree with the court's analysis and believe that the People versus Jowell, J-O-W-E-L-L decision, as part of its opinion, indicates that the prejudice that results has to be demonstrated in such a situation for it to really be outside of the analysis of harmless error. We do believe that appellee disclosed in its motion in limine prior to the motion's hearing the different theories under which statements of the child and the mother and which particular rules we believe pertain to those. Appellee would take issue that the court really didn't make any findings. We do believe that the court's ruling, although it could have been more directed to each particular statement, did make detailed findings as to whether things were not admitted for purposes of the truth, but related to a child's state of mind and the mother's state of mind, which in this particular case was very much a significant issue.
So, Mr. Thurkell, do you think you have confidence in identifying which statements were admitted as an exception to the hearsay rules versus those statements that were admitted under the statute? Do you know which ones the court was talking about?
I believe so, Your Honor. And again, if I linked the motion in limine from the appellee, as well as the presentation of evidence at the motion's hearing, the particular objections raised at the time of that, and then the detailed findings of the court, yes, I do believe that the Court of Appeals, as well as appellee, analyzing the situation, could address that with particular statements.
I'm sorry, I'll let you finish. I just want to make sure. Do you think some statements were admitted under the statute?
Under 1325.129?
Yes.
Your Honor, I don't believe so, and for the reasons stated by Mr. Ross, and we did go through basically a flowchart kind of analysis of the rules of evidence before we got to that point. And we did not have medical evidence in terms of unavailability of the child, and based on her age and emotional needs, a strategic decision was made there. But I do believe before you get to the 1325-129 analysis, and that's the reason that Appellee's motion was a motion in limine that went through that layers of analysis looking at a number of different rules. The two examples that I was going to give that I think in terms of the spontaneous kind of utterance by the child, one example was the child's statements to her mother about Satan lifting the child in the father's bed and being overall concerned about Satan. And that paired with the mother's statements about the child's emotional demeanor at the time of those statements, that the mother described her as being highly frightened at the time, are an example of that. We do believe on the other issues that as the argument has already begun to address today, there were several different definitions of dependency or neglect as to the child's status alleged by the appellee here. And any of the arguments raised on appeal by the appellant do not totally eliminate the application of those definitions. It's not by accident that the father was the first witness at the trial. And to the extent in his testimony, he admitted using physical discipline with the child. On one occasion, he admitted breaking the yardstick in half in the administration of that. And he did admit one occasion where he observed visible marks on the child as a result of his administration of discipline.
Mr. Thurkell, sorry to interrupt you. Do you agree with Mr. Ross that the subsequent treatment plan would be limited by the jury's findings here?
I do not, Your Honor. I'm not prepared, and I apologize for that. I do believe that there is a Colorado appellate case that indicates recognizing the nature of a dependency or neglect type of proceeding, that if new information about new and different concerns arises beyond what was alleged in the petition in dependency or neglect, that the court does have jurisdiction as part of its dispositional powers to address any and all issues that come up during a case, and over the course of the case to amend a treatment plan accordingly. What I do recall about that appellate case is there was an objection based on allegations that surfaced of a sexual nature, of inappropriate sexualized contact with the child. And if I remember correctly, that a sex offender management board approved evaluation was requested as part of that treatment plan and ordered, and that was a subject of that appeal. And I could certainly supplement the record to provide that case site. We would note that the father provided other testimony as the first witness to support additional definitions to determine the child's status as a dependent or neglected child in terms of his allegations about the actions of the child's mother that he witnessed directly, including three incidents he noted in his testimony. In one of those incidents, the mother allegedly threw and a glass candle broke on the child. The fact that there was an end table destroyed in that incident and a book was thrown, and that the mother had the child cornered on the edge of the bed in the child's bedroom and was yelling at the child in a loud tone of voice. The father's own testimony was that the child's reaction to that was that she was screaming hysterically. There was another incident. That incident was in March of 2013, according to the father's testimony. He also testified on the birthday of the child in 2013 in December that there was another incident where the mother was yelling and screaming, slamming doors and the like, and he was worried about the impact of that on his child. He also testified about a third incident in which he was concerned about his child because she was hitting herself, which in his testimony he attributed that to be the impact on the child of observing the mother. His testimony on that point further related that he did not contact the police, he did not contact the Department of Human Services, he did not seek therapy for his child, and that supported one of Appellant's theories of the case, that according to his own testimony, the child was being abused or neglected by the mother, and he did not take lawful steps to protect the child or prevent it from occurring. And any of the arguments about admissibility of Dr. Baropio's testimony or inappropriate admission of hearsay statements doesn't counter that there would have been at least those two independent bases of adjudication that are frankly not touched by any of the arguments raised by appellant.
So, Mr. Thurko, just to clarify, you think those, as to those bases for adjudication, they were not at all affected or informed by hearsay statements of the child?
That is the position of appellant, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And again, it somewhat depends on the trial court's analysis, too, as to whether statements were hearsay or non-hearsay, in terms of not offered for the truth of the matter asserted, but describing emotional state of the child, given the family dynamics at work here. We would note also that in support of the theory for harmless error, we had eyewitness testimony on a number of points, so that even if the Court of Appeals finds that the trial court erred in some of the ways alleged by the appellant, again, it amounts to harmless error and there was not prejudice. The credibility between the father and the mother and the other witnesses is certainly well within the province of the judge's decisions in terms of evidentiary objections and the findings made by the fact finder, the function served by the jury here. But the mother provided eyewitness accounts of what was described in the record as tongue wars that had supposedly been an activity between the father and the child that had occurred over a long period of time with many incidents of that in which the father and the child would suck on each other's tongues. The mother also provided an eyewitness account, of which I think there's considerable discretion for the judge and jury in this case about the credibility of that testimony, that the father, when the child exited from bathing and being naked, on times would grab her vaginal area, shake it, and would tickle her. And then there's a lot of corroboration between the various witnesses, the statements made by the child, her physical demonstration of that touching that occurred with the father, the child's description about the number of times that that occurred, the fact that the version of the child in making those statements as attributed by the mother are very consistent with the statements that the child made by two appellants, intake caseworker Kelly Allegretto, including similar kind of physical demonstration. There's also corroboration again in the testimony of the father that he was the one in the family who introduced the term split tail to describe at first his wife's vagina, and then after that he admitted that he used that term with respect to his daughter, and in fact that was his nickname for her. He also admitted at least one occasion that he specifically called her little split tail upon her exiting from bathing. And in that description, the first thing that his testimony provides that he did is he hugged her, and then he told her to go get a towel. There is so much corroboration in so many different ways that the court made appropriate rulings here under the rules of evidence about those statements. But in any event, if there was an error in any of that, it's harmless under the People v. Jowell analysis as a requirement. And because there was so much indication of credibility and reliability in this situation. Unless the court has other specific questions, I'm going to end my presentation at that point.
Very well. Thank you. Your co-counsel has a little over a minute and a half, if you wish to use it. Run the lectern down if you wish.
Oh, so that's okay.
Switch it down your right.
That's okay, Your Honor. Nancy Walker Johnson, I'm guardian ad litem for the minor child in this case. My bar number is 204A1, and I really do not have anything to add to what appellee has argued unless the court has questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case stands submitted. Counselor excused. We will issue written opinion in due course.